For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to a wintry edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sail, and today there's a snowy theme to the show. Lucy Foley whisks us off to the Scottish Highlands in her chilling crime thriller, The Hunting Party. Robert Kirkwood introduces me to a comedy classic set on the slopes of a Himalayan mountain. Sir Chris Bonington shares some of his own real-life tales from the snowy peaks. And we discover more about another cool customer fully at home in winter conditions, the Robin. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Lucy Foley's debut novel, The Book of Lost and Found, established her as a best-selling author of historical fiction. Her next two books confirmed this. The Hunting Party is a tense, contemporary thriller. Set over New Year 2019, it transports the reader to a remote hunting lodge in the Scottish Highlands, where a group of high-flying 30-somethings has gathered to relive their glory days at Oxford University. But when one of them is found dead on New Year's morning, the remaining members of the party, along with the housekeeper and the gamekeeper, must come to terms with the fact that there's a murderer among them. Lucy Foley, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
So the part of the Highlands that you write about, the wilderness where the hunting party goes for New Year, feels very, very real. Was it inspired by a place that you'd actually visited yourself?
It actually was. So my husband and I, we'd actually travelled to this place that it is very closely based on a couple of times before. And we travelled up there in the middle of winter one year. And I saw it in a completely different way. We were told beforehand that in the event of very heavy snowfall, we might not be able to get into the estate and we might not be able to get out if we were already there. And that got me thinking, this is sort of perfect kind of murder mystery setting.
And the hunting lodge where all the characters gather is a very isolated place. But you also deal with isolation in other forms, isolation within relationships and characters who feel that they are isolated from the rest of humanity. Was that something that you really wanted to explore more deeply?
I think it absolutely was, although I perhaps hadn't realised the extent to which I'd done that. And actually a very perceptive reader said to me the other day, all of the characters in the book are outsiders, in a sense. So every one of them in their own way. But I think that's very much the case. And I think that was where I started the book, actually thinking about these characters and why you would want to go and live on a kind of very remote estate, really cut off from the rest of humanity. So I probably found writing Doug, the gamekeeper, and Heather, the managers, perhaps most interesting in that sense.
Yes, and whereas the party that comes up from London sees the beauty in the wilderness, they, Doug and Heather, actually see the savagery in that beauty, don't they?
Absolutely. Nature red in tooth and claw. They know the dangers that sort of surround these guests, and they sort of have to kind of wrap these guests in cotton wool in a way, even though the guests don't realise this. But I think what I also loved writing was this scene where the guests start realising that they are separated from their kind of modcon. So they realise that there's no phone signal on the estate and the Wi-Fi has to actually be turned on if they want it. And that perhaps starts to kind of unleash something in them, something kind of latent and feral, I think.
Yes, you're always talking about the lizard brain or the...
Yes, the amygdala.
Yes. What gets unleashed when your sense of entitlement is thwarted.
Absolutely.
And I wondered if you'd also been on one of those annual regathering parties where you did meet up with friends from university who maybe the friendship wasn't quite as tight as it had been 10 years beforehand.
Definitely. I have to be really careful what I say here, but I have certainly had experiences like that. And I think New Year's Eve is a really funny time. You know, everyone feels like they should be doing something. They should be at a wild party. It can probably make you agree to things that you wouldn't otherwise agree to, and to catch ups with people that you maybe haven't seen for a long time, and probably perhaps with good reason. So it was sort of inspired by those two things, I think, that came together in this rather dark way.
I love the way that you describe the pressures of old established friendships and how there are expectations of how you're going to behave amongst each other, even if maybe, well, I think you use the lovely expression, it's a regathering of threads that have grown a bit looser over the years.
Definitely. I think there's this sort of really, you know, you have to be really sort of proactive about it when you meet up with old friends. You do have to find those things that united you and dredge them up maybe from history, and sometimes in the best way. It's a wonderful nostalgic process, but I think also it can sometimes highlight to you the fact that perhaps you don't have quite so much in common as you thought you did anymore.
The group of friends who gather in the story are, you use the expression, that they've led charmed lives. So they are the bright young things of 10 years before, and they have a real sense of entitlement. They're actually really not a particularly nice bunch, and I get the impression that you quite enjoy skewering them in the writing, rather like Evelyn Waugh did in his early novels.
Absolutely. I love that comparison to Evelyn Waugh. I'll take that, thank you. And I think that's also something that obviously the queen of golden age crime, Agatha Christie, does so well. They are characters that you love to hate, and I probably enjoyed writing them more than I should have done. You want to write characters that are compellingly awful. You don't want them to be boring in their awfulness. And in a way, I try to give some of them something not sympathetic about their characters, but something that, you know, the reader could kind of latch onto. But they are, in their different ways, all pretty awful. Apart from Heather, the manager of the estate, and Doug, the groundskeeper. Hopefully you feel that.
Yes, and the perspective that we get from their narrative voices is vital to the book. It's the reality, as opposed to the sort of the shimmer and glitter of the bright young things who've come up determined that they're going to impose their urban ways on this remote landscape.
Absolutely. I think one of the things I love about the kind of the Agatha Christie style murder mystery is that sort of upstairs, downstairs thing. And I was looking for a way to do that in a modern setting. And I thought the way to do that is to have these very entitled, moneyed, spoiled Londoners coming up and splashing their cash around. And so that's sort of how that worked.
You're one of the bright young things of historical fiction. You certainly made your name with your first three novels as a writer of historical fiction. What led you to start writing thrillers?
It's a funny thing. So I read very widely, and I came to writing as a reader. And when I wrote my first book, The Book of Lost and Found, it was very much because that was the book that I wanted to read. And so that's how I've always approached my writing. And I had started to think, I really want to read a modern take on the Golden Age murder mystery. That's what led me to start thinking, I want to write this sort of book. I then needed the setting, I needed the plot. And that was where this experience on this Snowdon Scottish estate came in.
You mentioned Golden Age writers such as Agatha Christie. It also called to mind for me Barbara Vine, Ruth Rendell.
Absolutely.
Yeah, her psychological thrillers, sort of putting a group of people in an isolated spot and turning up the pressure and seeing what blows.
Definitely. And I think Dorothy Sayers as well. Gosh, I've been reading another one recently and I now can't remember the name of the author, but it is from that. I think the wonderful thing is there, all the publishers seem to be sort of unearthing their Golden Age murder mystery writers and sort of repackaging them. And it's brilliant because I've discovered so many what would have been forgotten names through that.
The book was published first at the end of last year in audio and is now out in hardback, which, for those of us who rely on audio as our access to books, is fantastic news. Was that a conscious decision on your behalf?
To publish the audiobook first? Yeah, I think from the publishers, they just thought they were so excited about the audiobook and this wonderful cast they had lined up for it. I think they thought this is a wonderful way to get people really excited about the book, to kind of share clips of that audiobook online, to have those characters brought to life. So it's something I was really excited about.
Well, for me, it was terrific. I actually felt I was reading it in real time. It starts just before New Year's Eve and ends on New Year's Day. And it actually felt like I was living it. It was rather good. I felt we'd got the drop on the print readers, being given the exclusive beforehand.
Absolutely. And it's funny, I mean, I probably, half of the books that I read, I listen to in audiobook. So it was really exciting for me to have that.
You say you're a voracious reader. Do you read all genres, or do you get stuck into crime fiction and find that you've read nothing else for a couple of months?
So both, I would say, because I read very widely. I would say I read across genres, and I think that's sometimes a thing that writing books, and also having worked in the publishing industry, which I did, you can almost get hung up on genre, and actually people just want a really good read. But I would say that I also get obsessive, so I'll discover a particular author or a particular style of a book that I'm really enjoying, and I will read that for a few months, and then I need to kind of jolt myself out of it. So a bit of both.
And did you have much to do with picking the narrators for the audiobook? I should say there are five narrators because the story is told from five different points of view, and it's quite a stellar cast.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was really excited about it. I think I'm definitely going to have to write books with a cast of characters from now on, so I get a lovely cast of narrators. So it was really exciting, and they sent me, I think I had sort of five different options for each narrator, and it was really interesting. I thought, gosh, how am I going to choose? And then listening to each voice, I knew immediately they'd only read a few words, and I just knew that is Heather, or that is Doug, or that is Katie, and it was amazing how quickly that happened.
Are you going to stick with writing thrillers, or is there another historical novel on the way?
So there is another historical novel almost written. I think there's about 90,000 words written of that, but it's not a book yet. And I've also nearly finished the second thriller, so kind of doing a bit of plate juggling.
Where do you find time to read then? That's a phenomenal work rate if you're working two books at a time.
I mean, at times I do feel like pretty much all I'm doing is writing and reading, but that isn't such a bad thing. No, I mean, I love reading. And as I say, I came to writing from reading. It always amazes me that there are some writers who say, you know, I can't read anything while I'm writing. And I respect that, and that's amazing. But actually, for me, I need to have the clamour of different voices in my head and need to be reading all sorts of different stuff, because otherwise I think it would get very boring.
I read something that you said, that it was reading that had fired your imagination, and as a young person in your 30s, it actually had given you some of the life experience that your tender years hadn't given you yet.
Absolutely, because I think there's that kind of age-old saying, write what you know. I think that was Hemingway who said it, maybe, might be wrong. But actually, as a young person, 30-something, I don't have all that life experience. And actually, what I love about reading is that it takes me out of myself. It takes me out of my own small sphere and introduces me to all sorts of lives and experiences that I wouldn't have had. And you can absolutely do that as a writer. You just need to do your research.
And do you find it easy to write, or do you have to force yourself to your desk in the morning?
Oh, difficult. Depends on the day. I mean, literally, it's day by day. And some days, for whatever reason, I have a word count that I want to get to vaguely in my head. And some days I will get to that within a few hours. Other days I have to kind of chain myself to my desk, and it's much more difficult. I do think that the early part of writing a book, where you're just getting stuck in and you're kind of writing and you don't really have the kind of pressure on yourself to make it into something, that's the most wonderful time. And then when you start editing, that's where things get a lot more difficult and it feels more like work, but also very important.
So for our listeners who dream of becoming authors themselves, what would your one hint to them be?
It sounds really obvious, and it's probably almost too obvious, but I think just start writing, because that's almost what I have to tell myself every time I have an idea for a new book, because it can feel sort of so whole and perfect in your head that you almost don't want to blemish it by beginning the writing process, because as soon as you start writing, everything starts to tangle. But it's so important, and actually you need to almost get into the habit of writing. So just getting some words down on the page every day is a really important thing, and it might feel really difficult at first. And when I read back, I mean, I haven't read the back, but if I were to go back and read them, the things that I wrote at the very beginning, I would probably be really embarrassed. And I think it would be like reading an old diary or something, but it's a really important part of the process.
And I wondered also whether you feel that you have to know the ending of the book before you start writing. Certainly The Hunting Party starts with the disappearance that is at the heart of the book, but actually which forms pretty much the end of the book.
Absolutely. I think I found a real difference there between writing the historicals and the thriller, because probably with the historicals, I did have an idea of beginning, middle and end and vaguely how I would get there in between. But with the thriller, I realised from the very beginning I needed to be much more structured in the way I was approaching it, because I think with a murder mystery, plot is absolutely first and foremost. And if you don't have that essential underpinning structure, you have a bit of a mess. So I did know how it was going to end. There were things that surprised me along the way. So twists that I hadn't planned that I suddenly thought of as I started writing. And those are almost the most exciting things, I think, as a writer.
Yes, when the book starts to take you over a bit rather than the other way around, it's quite exciting, isn't it?
Absolutely. So,
Lucy Foley, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and I look forward to speaking to you in the future about your next thriller and or historical novel.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
There's different feeling this evening. Last night it was high spirits, a sense of camaraderie, togetherness. Tonight, the atmosphere carries a dangerous edge. It's as though that time out there, in all that wilderness, has put us on our guard. I wonder if the others can still see the deer, like me, buckling to her knees. It has become a dark thing between us, with the freighted quality of a guilty secret. We killed something together. We were all complicit, even if Emma was the one who took the shot. We did it for fun. Everyone, apart from me, seems to have fractured into their proper pairs, drawing back into their primary allegiances. Nick and Beau, Emma and Mark, Miranda snaking an arm around Julian's waist. At a little remove, Giles and Samira stand talking to each other in a low murmur. Miranda has persuaded them to leave Pryor in the cabin tonight so we could all be grown-ups this evening. But judging by Samira's mutinous expression, she isn't exactly happy about it. There's some enforced jollity as Julian carries a bottle of champagne around, pouring liberally. But everyone seems to be gulping it down, hardly tasting it, as though they are trying to drink themselves into the spirit of things. Of course, perhaps I'm imagining this, projecting onto them a tension that really exists only in my own mind. But I'm not so sure, because I see the quick, animal-darting looks they are all giving one another. I'm not alone in that. We are looking for something in each other's faces. But what is it? Familiarity? A reassuring reminder of all that holds us close? Or are we fearfully searching for some new element, glimpsed out there on that bleak mountainside? Something new and strange and violent.
The Hunting Party, written by Lucy Foley and narrated by a brilliant cast of narrators, is TB703876. And thanks to HarperCollins, all of Lucy Foley's books are available as talking books from the RNIB Library. You're listening to a special snowbound edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Still to come, a pair of hardy perennials, Sir Chris Bonington and Robin Redbreast. But before that, in this season of giving... Recommending a book to someone carries the same risk as giving any gift. Choose well and you've created a bond between you. Get it wrong and it's proof of your differences. And that's doubly true for humorous books. Saying that, I'm a great believer that it's the thought that counts, and receiving any gift puts a smile on my face. So I love being given the titles that you recommend for Educating Read. This week's suggestion came from someone we all know well, and proves just how well he knows my tastes. Over to you, Robert Kirkwood.
Well, we were discussing a future episode about books by comedians and generally funny books, and I asked Red if he'd ever read The Ascent of Rum Doodle, sort of assuming he had given his mountaineering background. But when he said he hadn't, I had no hesitation in recommending one of the funniest books I've read. I remember it coming into the Talking Book Studios in late 2001. It also came with the print book, which had a big cover splash mentioning a new introduction by Bill Bryson. And being a fan of Bill Bryson, and the fact that the print book wouldn't really be needed for the audio import, I slipped it into my bag for the tube ride home. Well, it was a mistake to read it on the tube, as at one point I didn't so much laugh as snort, startling some of the other passengers. So I waited until I could read it in private and loved it. I've returned to it again and again, and I've been lucky enough to get permission to share it on RNIB Connect Radio's Talking Book Show, and had absolutely no hesitation in recommending it to Red.
If Robert's glowing recommendation wasn't enough to convince me, then Bill Bryson's introduction to the Talking Books version I downloaded from the library soon had me in fits of laughter and keen to be educated. The Ascent of Rum Doodle is, as Bill Bryson says, the funniest book that people have never heard of. It's essentially a Shaggy Dog story in the form of a brilliant parody of classic mountaineering literature. It chronicles the fictional attempt by a group of wonderfully incompetent British climbers to conquer the world's highest peak, the seldom-seen Rum Doodle, elevation 40,000 and a half feet. They are led by Binder, who is as kindly and dogged as he is thick-skinned and dull. Other members of the expedition include Jungle, the route finder who keeps getting lost, Prone, the doctor who is always ill, Constant, the language expert who enrages the 30,000 porters with his attempts to communicate with them, and Pong, the terrifying cook whose meals drive the party to ever greater heights in the hope of losing him on the mountain.
One cannot praise too highly the work of the porters, without whom the expedition would have been doomed to failure. The only one of them who was not worth his weight in bohees was the cook, whose name was Pong. Of all the barbarous 3,000, Pong was probably the most disreputable and the most startling in appearance. His face had a peculiarly flattened look, as though it had been pressed in by a plane surface while it was still soft. This same flattening seemed to have spread to his soul, for a more morose, unresponsive, and uninspiring individual it would be impossible to imagine. His cooking was the reflection of his character. No matter what tempting delicacies he might extract from their tins, the final result was an invariable and appalling dark brown mess which had to be eaten with a strong spoon and contained the most revolting lumps. That we survived his ministrations must be considered a triumph of spirit over matter, for we suffered considerably from indigestion.
This hapless bunch meets every challenge with comfortably predictable disarray, rather like an episode of Dad's Army set in the Himalayas. It's all very silly, but hugely enjoyable, and as Robert predicted, I loved it. But that's not just because I'm a keen climber. With its tongue firmly in its cheek, the book does poke fun at the tendency of mountaineers to appear as distant as the peaks they hope to conquer, and of their memoirs to read like battlefield reports. However, anyone who has been on any kind of organised expedition will recognise the ill-assorted characters the situation throws together and enjoy the running gags. Comedy can be a very personal thing, and when it falls flat, it's horrible. As Bill Bryson writes in the foreword, perhaps no type of comedy is more difficult to sustain over the length of a book than a parody. And I know of none that does it more joyously than Rum Doodle. Perhaps the mark of a truly great comedy is when it takes on a life of its own in the real world. And as Robert Kirkwood found out when he interviewed W.E. Bowman's son, Guy, that's exactly what's happened with Rum Doodle. Robert started by asking whether, like him, most people have only come across the book after its republication with Bill Bryson's introduction.
Yes, I think it probably is, Robert. I mean, I think when it first came out in 1956, there were a small amount of people who bought it and read it and enjoyed it, and there were quite a few good reviews. And then it went out of print quite quickly, partly because the publishers folded, and it stayed kind of underground until the 1980s, and then there were various reprints in the 1980s. But I think when the new edition came out, with the introduction by Bill Bryson, I think that was when a lot of people discovered it, yeah.
Now, did you actually meet Bill Bryson?
I did, yes. I was very glad. I went to meet him with my mum in his London flat, and he was extremely welcoming and friendly and warm, and he was very good about doing the research. He was very thorough in researching what he was going to write in the introduction. I was very impressed by that.
Do you think your father would have enjoyed the new lease of life the book has had?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, he loved Rum Doodle, and he was very happy in the 1980s when it started to be republished, and I think he would have been extremely happy with Bill Bryson and everything that's happened since.
Now, it's the Isis version we have on Talking Books, using the voice of Terry Whale. How accurate do you think Terry Whale's narration is?
great job. I think he's got a great tone of voice, and he's just right for the humour. He doesn't kind of lay it on too thick. You know, he keeps it nice and dry and straight, and so you can laugh at it to yourself, and you can discover it for yourself like you would if you're reading it.
It's been a cult book in mountaineering circles for years, and there have been a few geographical features named in its honour. So where is the real Romdiddle?
Well, that's a very good question. Very good question, Robert. The first place to be named after the book is in Antarctica. It's near Mawson Station, and there was an Australian expedition, the Australian Antarctic Research Expedition, set up a weather station there, and one of the members was a fan of the book, and so they decided that they would call one of these little mountains around it, they would call it Romdiddle. Well, and then subsequently, I know of three other Romdiddles around the world. There's one in South Africa, and the rest of them are not mountains, they're bits of mountains, they're, you know, a crag or a face or something. So there's one in South Africa near Durban. There's one in the States on Pikes Peak, which is one of the largest mountains on the Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in Scotland near Loch Maree.
I believe there's also a guest house and a restaurant.
Absolutely, yes. There's a guest house in Australia, in Victoria. The guy who owns the guest house was part of the Australian Antarctic group, and he came back and he wanted to, you know, he wanted to call his guest house the Romdiddle Retreat, so he did.
Now tell us about the restaurant. I believe it's in Kathmandu.
That's right, yes, it's in Tamil in Kathmandu, and it was set up by two brothers, Ashok and Jyoti Pokharel, and they were great businessmen, and they realised that the book was a big favourite amongst climbers, and so they called their restaurant Romdiddle, and they have got the 40,000 and a half foot bar upstairs where there are lots of feet. And they've even got an Everest Summiteers Club. So if anyone goes to the top of Everest, then they are entitled to be a member of this club and get, I think they get free food and free drinks in this restaurant for life, actually.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. And I went there a few years ago, and I was very, very lucky that they gave me an honorary membership of this club, even though I haven't been anywhere near Everest, let alone to the top of it.
My thanks to Robert for a truly magnificent Educating Red suggestion. The Ascent of Romdiddle by W.E. Bowman is brilliantly narrated by Terry Whale, whose surname and voice make him perfectly suited to be a member of Binder's Expedition.
You're listening to a winter warmer edition of Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Now, with Romdiddle behind us, let's hear from the man who, quite literally, wrote the book on some of the most daring snow-capped adventures ever attempted.
Sir Chris Bonington is a world-famous pioneering climber and mountaineer. In a career spanning 7 decades to date, he became the first Briton to climb the north face of the Eiger, summited Everest aged 50, led numerous expeditions to seemingly impregnable peaks, and is still climbing aged 83. He's written extensively about his adventures in books such as Annapurna South Face and Everest the Hard Way. He records the challenges of mounting expeditions to achieve the impossible. And in autobiographical works such as I Chose to Climb, he explores the personal side of the path that he has chosen, including its many tragedies. Now he's brought those twin lines together in his new book, Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge. Keen to find out more, I caught up with him at the Petworth Festival. But first, a clip from the audiobook.
How far are our personalities and the course of our lives shaped by the genes we inherit, and how far by the environment in which we are brought up? I rather think it's a combination of the two. But with our genetic makeup, having a very strong influence and those traits becoming visible from a young age. Looking back at my immediate ancestors, quite a few of them were undoubtedly adventurous in a variety of ways. They weren't great explorers or sportspeople, but they carved out a distinct life of their own. On my mother's side, my grandmother, whom I knew as Nan, and who played a major part in my early upbringing, was brought up a Catholic, the 10th child of a family of 12. Her father, Timothy Doran, was born in 1814 in Enniscorthy, County Wexford, went to Sydney as a young man, attracted by stories of fortunes to be made from the gold rush that started around that time. Until the gold rush, the majority of migrants had been convicts. For Timothy, it was a step into the unknown, starting with the horrendous 4-month voyage in a cramped sailing ship around the Cape of Good Hope and across the empty southern Indian Ocean, battened down in the hold for days on end, drinking brackish water and eating weevil-infested food. He spent 20 years in Australia, but didn't talk about it. Only scraps of family legend persisted. He spent most of his time in Sydney, but ventured out to the lawless goldfields, where if he saw a shadow fall across his tent, he shot first, and only then went out to investigate.
Gordon Griffin reading the audible version of Ascent, A Life Spent Climbing on the Edge, by my guest, Sir Chris Bonington.
One thing I was really struck by in Ascent is just how much climbing is a matter of relationships, whether that's on the mountainside at home or with your sponsors.
Well, totally. I mean, the key relationships are the friendships you make in the mountains and with the people you climb, either in this country or in the Himalayas. But also, yes, your sponsors and, of course, the link at home and the support you get from home.
And the group of climbers that you were climbing with in the 50s, 60s, 70s and 80s, they really were pushing the envelope of what was possible at the time. Do you think we will ever see the like of that kind of pioneering climbing again?
I think my generation was incredibly lucky coming into adulthood immediately after the Second World War, when so much was still to be done. I mean, in fact, no 8,000 metre peaks have been climbed until, of course, Maurice Herzog reached the top of Annapurna. And so that there are a lot of big, obvious, exciting challenges to make. I think the problem that the modern climber has is that there are less obvious kind of challenges. They're climbing at an incredible high degree, but the general public and the media can't really get their heads around it.
And actually the things, the achievements that reach the public attention may not necessarily be the most impressive extreme climbs that are being done at the moment.
Well, yes, I mean, one of the problems is that firstly, they can't really get Everest out of their minds. And Everest is, you know, it's just endless stories of crowds going up the mountains and unfortunate disasters, while the real climbers are quietly getting on with doing a lot of very, very hard climbs.
As you say in the book, when you reached the summit of Everest in 1985, you had it pretty much to yourself. How do you feel about the hundreds of people going up in a line to the summit of Everest nowadays?
Well, thank God I managed to get up it before they allowed that to happen. I think it was inevitable, and I don't really begrudge it, because each one of those people, who a lot of them are comparatively inexperienced, but have forked out between $25,000 and $60,000 for the privilege of getting to the top of the mountain. But it is a huge experience in their lives. And what do you do? Do you ration it, in which case less people are going to be able to do it, or maybe only the very rich can do it? Or do you let it happen as it is? Where, yeah, a lot of people find that pleasure and excitement. And as far as people like myself go, if you want to have the mountains yourselves, there's still thousands of unclimbed peaks in the Himalayas.
I know reaching the summit of Everest was a major landmark for you. I wonder, was that your favourite climb? Do you have a favourite achievement?
No, I think reaching the summit of Everest was like an irritant. And I really wanted to get there. And I didn't realise just how important it was until I did get there. And then it was kind of, thank God I've got that out of the way. And after 85 and since then, I've had a whole series of exploratory expeditions, some of them quite zany expeditions, and all of them great fun.
And, of course, one of the most recent was climbing the Old Man of Hoy, aged 80. What led you to do that?
Well, it was primarily a great friend of mine, Leo Holding's idea. Leo Holding, he's one of our athletes. I'm chairman of Berghaus, which does outdoors clothing. And Leo said, well, look, why don't you come and do the Old Man of Hoy when you're 80? I'm the youngest person to have done it. He was 11 when he was taken up by his dad. And it meant a hell of a lot to me. It was a struggle to get up, but it was also for me a kind of a almost a catharsis that helped me after the loss of my wife.
And of course, you raised funds and awareness about motor neurone disease, which was clearly very important to you in that process too.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, it's a horrible disease and nobody, so little's known about it. It's incurable. And so the more funds one can actually raise to try to find a cure for motor neurone disease is hugely worthwhile.
Your account of climbing the Old Man of Hoy in I Chose to Climb stuck with me and is why I climbed it myself. And so I Chose to Climb has long been one of my favourite books. Do you have a favourite climbing book?
I would say actually The White Spider was an inspiration to me. Even earlier than that, W.H. Murray's Mountaineering in Scotland. And that was when I read that in the early 1950s. Really, the Alps and the Eiger and Everest and everything else was beyond my reach. But the wilds of Scotland were within my reach. And that really inspired me.
And finally, would you prefer to be on rock or on ice?
I love both. They're different. I think for sheer sensual pleasure, though, when you're climbing at your peak, there's nothing like really good rock climbing when you're pushing the limits.
I couldn't agree more. So, Chris Bonington, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On Air.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
A wide selection of Sir Chris's other books is available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. No Winter Warmer Read On special would be complete without that most iconic of Yuletide birds, the robin. But how much do we really know about our festive feathered friends? Well, not as much as natural historian Stephen Moss.
Stephen Moss is a naturalist and author. The Robin, a biography, reveals some interesting facts about Britain's favourite bird. He joined me down the line from Bath Spa University to tell me more. So, Stephen Moss, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much, Red.
So the book's full of fascinating facts about the robin. For instance, I never realised that the name Robin is actually a nickname.
Yes, I think that's one of the oddest things. I'm actually writing a book at the moment about bird names, and that's one of the things that came up when I was doing the research for that, which is that when, for example, my grandmother was bringing me up, she used to talk about Jenny Wren, Robin Redbreast, Tom Tit, you know, little nicknames for birds. And it was only later that it occurred to me that it's a bit like as if we were calling all wrens a Jenny, because Robin is actually the nickname. Redbreast was the original name. And in fact, there's a name even older than that, Ruddock, which means red little bird, a bit like Dunnock for brown little bird. So, yeah, Robin is basically a nickname.
And, of course, the robin doesn't have a particularly red breast. It's more orange, isn't it?
Well, I think so. I have to say, my wife disagrees with this. She said, well, of course it's red, but we do see colours differently, all of us. But to me, it's orange-red or reddish-orange. And, of course, the reason for this, it's not called robin orange breast, apart from the fact it's not alliterative and doesn't really scan. The main reason is that when the robin was called redbreast back in the 13th, 14th century and possibly even earlier, the colour orange didn't actually exist in the sense that it was considered a shade of red. It was only when oranges began to be imported from southern Europe into Britain in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries that people started adopting the name orange, which was the name of the fruit, for the colour that we now know as orange.
Ah, right, OK. So it's as recent as that.
Yeah, it's like light green and light blue don't really have their own names, do they? But orange does, but it's really a sort of pale red.
And where did the link between the robin and Christmas come from?
I think there's two reasons for this. The obvious reason is that robins are very tame in winter. Robins are largely insectivorous birds. So they eat insects, they eat invertebrates, mostly from the soil or the grass. So you see them hopping around your lawn or your flower bed. And in winter, particularly in the old days when there was a lot of ice and snow in winter just coming up to Christmas, which there isn't much now, but robins would come to the back doorstep looking for food, and people would give food, perhaps scraps of bread or a little bit of lard or something to them. And so they became associated with that season. And of course, they are a bird that's around in our gardens in winter. Then what happened was when the first penny post started in 1840, the first postmen wore red uniforms and were nicknamed robins. And someone had the bright idea of putting a picture of a robin on a card and marketing it as a Christmas card. This was a new thing because, of course, before then you couldn't post cards, so people didn't really give cards to each other. So robins were put on Christmas cards and they often had a little letter in their beak, and the idea was they were representing the postman.
The book brims over with fascinating facts. It's a magpie's delight. But the other fact I hadn't realised is just how British this love of robins is. And that's closely linked to us not having wild boars in our woods.
That's right. We do now, of course, in a few woods like the Forest of Dean and the Ashdown Forest, we've got wild boars. But for over 500 years, there were no wild boars in Britain. Now, if you go to the continent and you talk to people there, they see robins. I've seen robins in Spain and France, but they're usually in woods. They're not normally, well, they don't have as many gardens as us, but they're a bird of woodland. They're quite a shy bird. And in ancient times, and still now in places like France, robins would follow wild boars around because, as you know, wild boars dig up the soil with those fearsome tusks, and they're always turning over earth in forests. And of course, that allows the robin to find food. Now, when robins are in Britain, they don't have wild boars, so they started following us around, and particularly probably 100 or so years ago when gardening started to become very popular, you'd find that when you were digging up the soil, a robin would turn up next to you, and you think, oh, isn't that lovely? What a lovely little bird. It's so affectionate and friendly. Well, it is, but it's only affectionate and friendly. It's what, again, my mum would have called cupboard love. It basically wants the food you're unearthing. So you turn over the soil, it nips down and grabs a worm, sits on your spade, everyone's happy. But actually, it's exploiting us.
And obviously very successfully, because you say there are 6 million mating pairs within the UK?
Yes, roughly. It's always hard to estimate, but that's the general estimate. And that makes it Britain's second commonest bird. Now, can you guess? Well, you've probably read the book, but I bet if I'd asked you before you read the book, you wouldn't know what our commonest bird is.
I believe it's the wren, isn't it?
It is the wren, yeah, with about 10 million pairs in Britain and Ireland, probably about 8 million in Britain. Now, people never believe that.
And yet I wouldn't recognise, well, I can't see, but I wouldn't have recognised a wren when I could see. And yet a robin is instantly recognisable to us all.
Yes, what you would recognise of the wren is its song, of course. The wren has this wonderfully loud song. It's probably the loudest song of any tiny British bird. It's a very small bird, only weighs about 8-10 grams, which is about a third of an ounce. And yet it has incredibly loud song with what my friend Dominic Cousins, a fellow nature writer, calls the twiddle in the middle. And he always says that a wren reminds him of an opera diva giving her all in the last act, because they really do sing very loudly with great energy. So if you hear that song, you'll hear that all over the place. Even around now, even in winter, you hear them.
You mentioned how small the wren is, but the robin isn't much bigger. You said roughly the same weight as two new £1 coins.
Yeah, I think it's about 12 grams, a robin, 12, 15 grams. It's not very big. So, yeah, it's a pretty small bird, but all songbirds are. You know, they're small and light because they need to fly. A mammal of the same size would be 3 or 4 times the weight because, of course, it doesn't need to get airborne. So it's like all small birds, robins have very delicate wings, hollow bones, you know, so they're able to get airborne.
One of the great pleasures throughout the year is hearing robins, usually in my case, singing on lampposts. They're fiercely territorial. And what I hadn't realised is that both male and female robins are territorial and both sing.
Yes, that's very unusual. Amongst British birds, the robin's really the only bird where the female regularly holds territory and sings. All the others, it's the male bird singing. And the other unusual thing about robins is they hold territory, different territories sometimes, smaller ones, but they hold them all year round. So the male and female, the male will hold the territory in the spring and summer, the female will breed with him, and then in autumn they will split up, and she will sometimes actually fly all the way over to France or Spain, or she may just fly a little bit further away, and she will find a small territory and she will defend it by singing. And it's probably all about food. Most things in nature are about food. But that means that you do hear robins throughout the year. You also, as you mentioned, hear them at night. Now, this is, again, for two reasons. One is robins have taken very well to cities and towns where there are streetlights, but they also have very good sight. They have these big black eyes, beady eyes, and that means that they are able to see earlier in the morning and later at night than other birds. So you often hear a robin first thing in the dawn chorus. But what also happens now is robins get woken up at night by the streetlights come on. The robin's woken up, it starts singing. And next door, because their territories are so tiny in cities, the next male robin starts singing. And it's a bit like a sort of arms race or you know, a set of dominoes. Once one starts singing, the other one can't resist because he's worried about defending his territory. And so, of course, you do get robins singing at night, and people then think they're nightingales because, of course, as you know, the nightingale's the only bird that sings at night, except it isn't.
But they are the same family.
They are, yes. Yeah, they are. Robins are funny. They're the only bird now in their genus. There's lots of birds around the world called robin or robin chat, lots of birds with robin in their name. Some of them are closely related. Distantly related to robins, they're chats, as we call them, like little miniature thrushes. But an awful lot of them aren't. The one in America, the American robin, is basically a big beefy thrush, a bit like very closely related to our blackbird, but with a sort of orangey, rusty breast. And basically, the Pilgrim Fathers went over there, someone was homesick, they saw a bird with a reddish breast, called it a robin.
So is this love of the robin only a British and expat thing, or would you find robins being as popular in China or Asia or whatever?
Not at all. No, culturally, it's a very British thing. The Americans love their robin. In fact, recently they decided in America to change all the names of all the birds called robin to thrush, because they are all thrushes. And the one they wouldn't change was American robin, because they felt that with the cultural associations, you know, Michael Jackson's song Rockin' Robin, or the old song When the Rob Rob Robin Comes Bob Bob Bobbing Along, they love their robins as well, but it's a different species. So no, our robin, if you go to the continent, people know it and they like it, but it's no different from perhaps a stone chat or a black redstart or a redstart or these other very beautiful birds in that family. But it's not considered culturally special as our robin is.
You're obviously a very keen ornithologist or birdwatcher. I don't know.
Yeah, no. Birdwatcher. I suppose I am an ornithologist. I'm not a trained ornithologist because I'm not a scientist. And to be honest, I'm equally interested in the cultural side of birds. So the robin, a biography, as we called it, is actually, I suppose, half of it is science and my own observations, and the other half is the culture of robins, because I just find that side of birds endlessly fascinating.
And robins have a habit of making nests in some very bizarre places.
Yeah, I think of all birds, they're probably the weirdest in terms of that. Mostly they'll nest in sort of shrubbery, hedgerows, things like honeysuckle, clematis. You know, they'll find a little area and build a little open nest out of grass and moss and lay their eggs in. And it has to be hidden away, but they'll also nest in almost any crevice. So outside toilets, on top of a cistern, in sheds, in pillar boxes, in people's coat pockets, in a famously in an unmade bed, in the engine of a plane, in the engine of a Land Rover. You know, they're just looking for a safe place to lay their eggs. That's what's funny about robins. We put all this sort of culture on top of them, so mostly benevolent and some not. But of course, they're just doing what birds do. They're trying to raise a family and they're doing it quickly. Robins live fast and die young, probably only live a year or two mostly. Many of them died for their first birthday, so they have to get going. So they're really just doing what birds do, but we've associated this with so many aspects of our own lives.
The way you describe the robin, its opportunism, the way it cocks its head when it looks at you whilst you're gardening, whilst it's waiting for its worms, and the fact that it can also be very aggressive, but also very friendly seeming, it does seem to have some rather human traits. Do you think that's why we in Britain have taken it quite so close to our hearts, that we see ourselves in the bird?
I think so. I think that's often the case. Having said that, of course, two groups of birds that have very human traits in that they're very clever, they are very opportunistic, are crows and gulls. And we tend to not like crows and gulls, and we particularly don't like them when they move into our territory, so gulls in cities. So I think with the robin, it looks undeniably extremely cute. Those big eyes, the big round head, the plump breast, the red. Male and females, of course, both have a red breast. And even though the red breast is actually a signal of aggression, to us, it's a symbol of beauty. So I think really it's that. I think it's because they live alongside us rather than being particularly like us. We got a new Labrador puppy about 4 or 5 months ago called Rosie, and she's a beautiful red fox Labrador, rather almost like an orange robin-y colour, actually, a bit lighter. And one day I was sitting in my office, as I am now, out in the Somerset countryside in my garden, and I had the door open because it was the summer, so this was back in June, July, and suddenly this little bird rushed in, being chased by a very frantic and barking Rosie. And it was a baby robin. It must have been July, because it was just molting. I just had the beginnings of the red breast on the speckled plumage. And luckily, I grabbed it very quickly and very carefully and took it down the garden and released it over the hedge. And it was very happy, because Rosie probably would have made short work of it because she's quite curious about things like that. So, yeah, that was my sort of embarrassing story. The others are mostly in the book. There's an awful lot of stuff, as you say, in the book. It was a delight to write. I'm hoping to do The Wren next. You never know if the publishers are listening. And we're hoping, you've asked about an audio book. I've done audio books before for the two books I did with my friend Brett Westwood. We did Tweet of the Day and we did Wonderland, and they're both available on audiobook. And they usually tend to be a bit of an afterthought, sadly, and they're done after the book's out. So I promise you, I am lobbying for an audiobook of The Robin, partly because it's a lovely short book, so I better read it in a day, but partly because I think people would really enjoy it, and it will be lovely for your listeners to be able to hear it read by my dulcet tones, hopefully.
In the meantime, I've been enjoying it read by my wife and my daughters, both of whom are rather impressed by the feisty female Robins.
Absolutely. Quite right.
I understand from them that the illustrations and especially the cover art is absolutely beautiful. So I'm sure it'll be finding its way into many a Christmas stocking.
I do hope so, yeah. It was a lovely book to write. It's always lovely when people have read a book I've written and say to me, well, someone said to me a few years ago, a woman came up and she said, oh, I loved your book. She said, but it was very easy to read. And then she stopped herself and said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. That's not the right thing at all to say to a proper nature writer. And I said, it's a lovely thing to say. Thank you so much, because of course I want it to be easy to read. But the Robin book's very easy to read, you know. I promise you, there's not a lot of heavy science, bit of feminism, as you say, with the feisty females, and, you know, hopefully something for everyone.
Stephen Moss's book, The Robin, A Biography, is out now in print and ebook. And since that interview, Stephen has indeed recorded an audiobook version of The Robin, and it's flying off the shelves.
Ah, yes, I remember that one. And that one, Sunday Roasts. I'm Gary Moritz, and I'm here each week bringing you musical memories all to be heard on Sunset Melodies on Wednesdays at 7 and Sundays at 6 here on RNIB Connect Radio. It's where we like to take it nice and easy.
Let's take it nice and easy.
Now, I don't remember that fella. Frank who?
And finally, Tricia Ashley is a best-selling author, renowned for writing cosy, romantic comedies, often set against a snow-laden landscape. She's also visually impaired. And many of her novels, including her latest, The Christmas Invitation, are available from the RNIB library. Here she is with the books of her life.
So, Tricia, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
The first book as a child that I found really magical was called The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Gouge. It's just so magical. So I think that really inspired me to want to write my own. But of course I read the usual Enid Blyton's. I mean, she creates wonderful worlds for children to go into. She writes so simply that it's very accessible, but to write simply is a lot harder than you think it is. It's not an easy thing to do.
The carriage gave another lurch, and Maria Merriweather, Miss Heliotrope and Wiggins once more fell into each other's arms, sighed, gasped, righted themselves, and fixed their attention upon those objects which were for each of them at this trying moment the source of courage and strength. Maria gazed at her boots. Miss Heliotrope restored her spectacles to their proper position, picked up the worn brown volume of French essays from the floor, popped a peppermint into her mouth, and peered once more in the dim light at the wiggly black print on the yellowed page. Wiggins, meanwhile, pursued with his tongue the taste of the long-since digested dinner that still lingered among his whiskers.
The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Gouge is TB7957. It's narrated by Josephine Chewson. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I'm very taken with a contemporary crime writer called Ellie Griffiths, who's written two series. One is about Max Mephisto, who's a magician, which is very amusing, and the other one is about Ruth Gallagher, and that's a long series. So whenever she brings a new one out, which is every year, I reread the whole lot. They have the first, I think, five at the RNAB library. And I've suggested they get the others pronto so I can listen to them on that too.
The letter has been forwarded from the university.
Hi, Ruth. Dan here, Dan Golding. I hope you remember me, as otherwise this is going to get embarrassing. How is life treating you? I'm in the inhospitable and frozen north teaching archaeology at Pendle University. I know you're at North Norfolk. In fact, I've been following your career with interest and admiration. I know that you are one of the country's leading experts on bone preservation. So that's why I'm writing. Although, of course, it would be great to catch up. Do you see anything of Kaz these days, or Roly, or Val? I've made a discovery, Ruth, and it could be big. It could be huge. But I need your help. I need a second opinion on the bones. Things are a little sensitive here, which is why I'm writing, not emailing. Can you ring me on the number below? I think you'll be interested. Have you heard of the Raven King? Well, I think I've found him.
Dying Fall by Ellie Griffiths is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB21661, narrated by Karen Cass.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I'm reading or listening again on USB sticks to the Harry Potter books because I'd never read them. I've seen the films, but I'd never read the books because I'm very contrary. So if everyone else is running in one direction, I'm ambling off in the other. So I always catch up with things later than everybody else. And I'm really enjoying them. They're so well written and quirky, but they're getting very, very dark. Now I'm nearing the end.
Nearly 10 years had passed since the Dursleys had woken up to find their nephew on the front step. But Privet Drive had hardly changed at all. The sun rose on the same tidy front gardens and lit up the brass No. 4 on the Dursleys' front door. It crept into their living room, which was almost exactly the same as it had been on the night when Mr. Dursley had seen that fateful news report about the owls. Only the photographs on the mantelpiece really showed how much time had passed. 10 years ago, there had been lots of pictures of what looked like a large pink beach ball wearing different coloured bobble hats. But Dudley Dursley was no longer a baby, and now the photographs showed a large blonde boy riding his first bicycle, on a roundabout at the fair, playing a computer game with his father, being hugged and kissed by his mother. The room held no sign at all that another boy lived in the house too. Yet Harry Potter was still there, asleep at the moment, but not for long.
Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone by J.K. Rowling is narrated by Stephen Fry. The complete series is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Well, Trisha Ashley, thank you so much for sharing the books of your life with Read On listeners.
Thank you.
And you can find a full interview with Trisha, along with hundreds of other book-related features, by subscribing to the Read On podcast. Simply search your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. Alas, that's all we've got time for in this special winter edition. My thanks to all my guests, producer Hannah, and to all of you for listening. Read On will be back at the same time next week, and you can always follow us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, and producer Robert is at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on!